This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show and welcome to another masterclass. Before we get into that, I'm just going to get a little bit of housekeeping out of the way. As usual, if you enjoy this episode, and if you enjoy any of the episodes, please go and give us a review on iTunes. And if you can write one as well, that would be fantastic. But if you can't write one, then just rate us with stars. Secondly, we are going to start asking for donations for this show. Now, we don't get paid. We don't carry any advertising. I think Edwina and my guests and Patrick do it for love, as do I. Gilberto spends a lot of time editing these. So we're going to start asking for donations, and we're going to ask for donations in cryptocurrency because, of course, it's 2018 and that's what you do. So if you go to the show notes, you'll see donation addresses for Bitcoin, Litecoin, Ethereum, and Bitcoin Cash. So anything you can give us in any of those would be totally appreciated. As I said, this is a masterclass. We don't follow the normal format of the show. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about a particular subject for about 45 minutes in the marketing field, and hopefully you're going to learn quite a lot from it. And this one, we're going to talk about how you price anything. So we mentioned price a couple of podcasts ago in the masterclass when we talked about the seven P's. Price is obviously one of the important ones, and it's something that I see a lot of people get wrong. And last, but absolutely not, definitely not least, I've ditched Simon Bell because he doesn't know enough about marketing. And I've invited back the fantastic Kim O'Gorman again to join me in the masterclass. So welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Simon.
We're going to talk about price, and I'm going to put you right on the spot here. How long ago did you start your business?
5 years to the day, to be honest. Is that, well, it's five wow. years today since I left corporate land and started Kim O'Gorman Marketing Solutions. So, yes,
maybe
it's an
anniversary
of sorts.
Maybe we should have cake or something.
Yeah, oh, that sounds good.
Or a cake and a glass of champagne or something. Yeah. Yes. When you first started it, how did you price yourself? What did you think you were going to do in terms of charging people?
Really badly. I decided I set an hourly rate for myself, and then depending what the project was, estimated that the hours required and priced it, provided a quote that way. And pretty much 100% of the time, grossly underestimated the time involved. And for the first decent length of time, I probably would have earned more money working at McDonald's on an hourly rate than I actually was able to pay myself. So I learned pretty quickly to ditch hourly rates and work more on the value I provide rather than how long it takes.
So you now price yourself in terms of like project-based rather than hourly?
Yeah, so it depends on what aspect of marketing I'm working with a client, but generally I'll provide a package, you know, a cost that my package is started at a certain rate, and then depending what's required, there may be add-ons as well. And that does obviously cover my own costs, but it gives people a better idea when they're researching my services as to what they might be up for. And it helps, I guess, remove those clients who might not want to be spending, well, any money or investing in their marketing. So it saves some time as well. But it also gives me a better way to work with my time, or if I'm getting any support or contractors involved as well.
When you originally started with an hourly rate, how did you pick that rate? Was it just sort of here's a number and I feel comfortable with it? Or was it something that you knew someone else was charging a similar amount or that sort of thing?
Yeah, I sort of looked around the market to see what was being charged. And obviously, in marketing consulting, there's a range of offerings. So there's large agencies that charge several hundred dollars an hour. And there's new people, I guess, who charge a bit less, or if they're specialists, so copywriters might have charged a bit less, or social media consultants often charge sort of low hourly rates if they're more from the sort of VA aspect rather than a a strategy aspect. So I had a look in the market and felt there was a price that I felt comfortable with, and started with that.
It's interesting because in the last couple of months, I've been faced with two people who were charged, who were well undercharging what they should be charging. And the first one, ironically, was my gardener. And I know that's going to sound extremely posh. People are sitting there going, he's got a gardener. And I just want to stress, I don't have a particularly big garden, but I'm not a particularly big fan either of mowing, edging, or, you know, chopping down, things like that. And I decided probably a couple of months ago that I would actually start paying for someone to do it, because I was over it. And the guy came around and he probably did, it must have been a couple of hours work, because it's a couple of hours work to mow a couple of lawns, clear up all the leaves, chop down some hedges, etc., etc. And he sends me a text message, and I said, how much do I owe you? And he said, $50.
Wow.
And exactly. You can imagine what my reaction was at that point. And I actually texted him back and said, I'm not paying you $50. I'll give you $100 for it. And we actually got into we got into a long discussion about how he wasn't going to take the $100. He was going to take something closer to 50. And I ended up having to email him and explain to him why he was ridiculously underpricing himself for the work he'd just carried out. It turned out I was actually his first job, his first ever gardening job.
God, I bet he worked for more like you, who haggle up and
well,
down.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think he was genuinely not sure what to charge. He's like, I've got a job. This is my first job. Let's just go and do it and see what happens.
And I think the challenge for a lot of service providers is you sort of think, oh, well, if I was on, and my maths, you know, isn't necessarily my strong point, but if you go, my, you know, a yearly salary when I was working in whatever job I was in was X amount, and if I divide that by 40 hours a week, and maybe he got to $25.
Yeah.
But that's assuming that 8 hours of every day is mowing and working, you know, in the job that you'll get paid that hourly rate for, and that's not counting on marketing or accounting or looking for the clients or tidying up, you know, all of those things. And I think that's the trap so many service providers especially fall into, is not actually accounting for all the hours you're working in your business. And if you're just charging your billables at what you've broken your hourly rate down, you'll very quickly realize you're not going to make enough money.
And actually, that was the email I sent back to him, because I said to him, you can't charge $50. And I'd gone back and calculated, I'd done exactly what you said on an email to him. This sounds like, to everyone, I'm shooting myself in the foot here dreadfully by encouraging him to put his price up to me. But I generally feel guilty about him doing all that work for $50. But I took the exact same approach that you've just mentioned. As I said to him, let's assume that you want to earn $80,000 a year. And again, for those of you listening outside of Australia, it's 80,000 Australian dollars. I said, let's assume that that's what you want to earn. Now, I also have got to assume that you want to have, let's say, 4 weeks holiday at some point. You know, there's going to be time around the year when you want to take time off. So you've only actually got 48 weeks of the year to earn that 80,000. Plus, you've got to pay for your mobile phone, your car, your petrol, new equipment, your accounting package. And I added all those numbers up. And I said, if you were working for 8 hours a day, 48 weeks a year, this is what your hourly rate should be. However, the one thing I then said to him was, bear in mind, you're not always going to be 100% busy. You know, you're
or
not
well
going
necessarily,
to be,
you know.
Or well, absolutely, yeah. And, you know, and you might have insurance for, you know, being sick and things like that. But you can't afford, if you're pricing it like this, you've got to literally be doing 8 hours work every day for 48 weeks a year without fail. So what I then tried to do was to sort of say to him, right, well, what you need to do is some padding in this. You need to have a profit margin in here that allows you to say, well, if I haven't got a job on a Friday, it's not the end of the world. I've still made enough from Monday to Thursday to cover me for everything I need. So that's kind of exactly, that's sort of exactly where you kind of came from with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing, the challenge is, and at the moment we're talking about service-based businesses, but and products are different kettle of fish. But the challenge for service providers is definitely you are swapping time for money effectively. And so that's a situation you need to actually get your head around and exactly what you said, work out what your financial goals are, how you can get there. And fair enough, if you did those sums and the mailman was then charging $120 an hour, he's pricing himself out of a certain market for sure. And that's the next question, is sort of saying, will your target market pay for the rate you're charging? So whether it's for a service or for a product, you have to sit back and say, sort of say, who are you targeting and will they pay that? And for some, my experience, and I've heard this a lot around the place, is, you know, if you price yourself too low, the audience you attract are actually way more difficult to deal with than absolutely, if you price yourself at the premium end of the market. And to do that, you have to offer better customer service. Your communication has to be outstanding. You have to give them a reason to pay more. But people who are prepared to put their hands in their pocket and pay your value are usually much easier to deal with. They won't quibble over a dollar here or there. You know, they won't question what you're doing so much because they trust you and put value in you. So that's the other consideration, is often people will go as cheap as they can because they see that as a way of being competitive. But when you compete on price, you're basically, if that's your only point of differentiation from everyone else in the market, the price will just keep going down and down and down, because as soon as they discount, then you have to discount, and eventually that just leads to rack and ruin.
And I, you know, back in my agency days, that you're spot on. The cheapest jobs were the hardest, were often caused the biggest problem. Not only the biggest problem because they expected so much, but also they became the ones that were hardest to get money out of in terms of paying their bills.
And also because if you don't just, value yourself,
late payers.
They will pay late. But if you don't value yourself, then why should they value you? So then they will question the value more. Whereas if you can demonstrate clearly that you're worth, you know, not even a premium price necessarily, but at least the market rate, then you'll be valued at that level.
It's a dangerous space to be in, because certainly when you start a business, you want to take every job that walks through the door. And I can imagine, you know, when you started your consultancy, when I started my agency, anybody who walked in the door and said, "I've got $300 and I want you to design me a logo," you'd take it. And you'd end up doing an insane amount of work for a stupid amount of money.
Absolutely.
But you just felt you had to take it.
Yeah. And there's still times, I'll admit now, there's times if, and it hasn't been quiet for a while, which is great, but if I'm sort of looking ahead a few months and not sure if big jobs are going to come through or what's happening, you're still tempted to accept jobs that maybe you're not willing, you wouldn't normally be willing to do, or that don't really feel right, just to get those, you know, to get the revenue happening. And I think that's also a challenge. And the other one is really, if we could sort of go back to the product side, and I think, I remember it was one of your guests that you interviewed, I think late last year, Simon, and I'm not sure if it was Mike Boyd, but someone was talking about their product was actually ended up being targeted at uni students. And, you know, you think of the different areas of the market that you could be targeting, and uni students is an example. A lot of people sort of look for targeting, you know, uni students or mums of young kids or different areas of the market that might not have a lot of money. So you have to really be sure that they value what you're offering. So I just remembered Mike's interview, and in that case, he was selling, beer kegs, renting beer kegs. Well, that's a high priority to a uni student, so they probably would find the money for that.
Yeah.
If it was a cleaning service, then probably not so much. So, you know, it's you need to think about what they value the most, and then price accordingly. Because if it's not of a high value, but that is your target market, then you do need to drop prices or figure out a way to provide it in a more economical manner.
I think when I was a uni student, I would spend all my money on records. This is back when records were records, proper vinyl things.
Showing your age.
And
now,
you'd spend, you know, on Saturday, you save all your money and go and buy, you know, go and buy some records. But then throughout the week, you'd live on a measly budget for food. So it's exactly, as you say, it's where people see that or perceive that value to be. So I think the other interesting thing there is to work out what the market will pay or what you can make them pay. And I don't want that to sound hideously capitalist, although it probably does. But certainly there's places in the market that, and especially if you have a strong brand, where the market will pay a certain level that, you know, even if that seems that you're getting a ridiculously high profit or, you know, you're making too much money, but if the market's willing to sustain that, then there's no reason why you shouldn't be charging that amount of money, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, because you're obviously providing some kind of value. I mean, otherwise, why would certain shoes be $3,000 a pair, or why would certain handbags be that much money? Whatever it is that you're providing that target audience, whether it's prestige or some sort of popularity or whatever it might be, you know, those handbags and shoes certainly don't cost probably any more than the $80 pair in the shop, you know, at the local supermarket, at the local shopping center. I think if you provide enough value, then you can charge higher rates. And your case with your gardener is a perfect example. You're prepared to pay that amount of money. So he's mad for arguing with you. I understand why. And I think a lot of people, especially when they're starting out, don't want to be seen to be ripping people off. You know, Australian has that attitude of whether it's a tall poppy syndrome, or you don't want to be seen as a, you know, rip-off artist or whatever. So people will often undervalue or underprice themselves. And also when you're starting off, you want people to tell their friends and tell their friends, and that's great. But if you're charging a price that you can't actually sustain, so Simon, in your case, if you he charged you $50 for 2 hours work and you didn't talk him up in his pricing, but if you went to your mate next door and said, hey, he's only $50, then he has that customer, and then the next one, and it is a lot harder to put your price up than it is to discuss a deal with someone.
Absolutely.
So if you start discounted, then you just can't get your price up in any easy way, that's for sure.
We'll talk about that discounting cycle in a minute, because I think that's really important to touch on. The other example, there was another example I wanted to give of something that I paid for last weekend that I was completely prepared to pay anything for. And I went to, have you seen this Zero Latency virtual reality gaming place? Yes. Have you been?
No. I've heard of it. I haven't
definitely
been.
Definitely go, unless you're a bit afraid of zombies, and then perhaps don't go.
So don't take the seven-year-old then? No, okay.
No, well, it's 13 plus, so they're definitely staying at home. So, but I went to this, and it's only 45 minutes, and it's an experience. So you put on the virtual reality headset. It's a free roaming experience as well, so you're not tied to a cable or anything. And you've got the headphones on, you've got a microphone, you've got a gun, plastic gun, obviously. And you're in this experience with, I was in with five other friends. You can maximum of eight people, whatever. Now that was charged to $66. And to be honest with you, I probably would have paid more. But it was priced to a point where I just went, you know what? I have to experience this, because this is first gen virtual reality technology here that we're seeing. And, you know, I want to be there in 5 years' time when it's gone on leaps and bounds, and we can, you know, we can see how far it's gone. But I want to see this, do you know what I mean, in today's tech. So it's funny, but I didn't even look at the price. It wasn't even a consideration, because I wanted to experience it so much.
And ideally, as businesses, that's what we want our branding and marketing to do, so that people don't really, because like that price is a factor well down the list of a number of other things. And that's why, I mean, you look at hairdressers, you know, why is it a haircut's a haircut? I mean, well, they can butcher a haircut, I guess, but generally the skill's the same or the outcome is the same, but people are charging vastly different prices. I mean, I probably wouldn't pay to go into a gaming situation like that. Not that I think that's actually a pretty good price. That's not something that makes me shriek in horror. But I spend more on cheese than the average person. It's like cheese is a high priority for me. Now, other people look at what the cheeses I buy and go, well, why would you spend that on that cheese when you can get the $3.99 one from Aldi?
I'm going to interrupt here. How much do you spend on cheese a week, Kim?
A week? Oh, look, I have never added it up, and it's probably scary, but depends. If we've got people coming over, I'd probably easily spend $30 or $40 on cheese for a few people. I love my cheese.
Big cheese budget.
For Mother's Day, the last 2 years in a row, my husband has bought me about 3 kilos of cheese from a Swiss cheese maker up the coast. And then for Father's Day, he got the fondue set. So we like a bit of cheese around this house.
Wow.
But again, so I really love that. I don't necessarily drink a heap of alcohol, so I'm not spending it on that. So every target audience, you need to know your consumers well enough to know what is important to them and what's not, and then position your product or service that way.
So just to recap quickly, because I got 4 points here that we were going to talk about how to price anything. Number one, work to what you want to earn. So, you know, just to recap, work out what you think is a comfortable salary, make sure you're adding on expenses, make sure you're compensating for the fact that you might not be working all the time, et cetera, et cetera. Second thing is work to what the market will pay or what you can make them pay. So, you know, thinking about your brand and thinking about what is out there already, what people are willing to pay already. The third thing I was going to say was work on the basis of the profit that you want to make. And this is probably, I think, more for products than it is for people and for services. So I was actually reading the other day about, and I'll put you on the spot here, how much do you reckon, I don't know whether, are you an iPhone, are you a Mac lady?
Apple through and through.
And I'm going to do this in US dollars because the article I found was in the US. What do you reckon it costs? What do you reckon the profit margin is on the iPhone X?
Oh.
And I'm going to
bear in mind. What are they worth? They're about $1,100, $1,200, aren't they?
Well, I'll give you the cheapest one is $999 in the US.
Yeah. I would say, would it go above $200 in costs?
$200.
Yeah, I reckon.
It costs, according to Reuters, $357.50 US.
Wow, so it's still
to make an iPhone X, an entry level iPhone X.
So that's still a what, 60% ish?
Yes. Yeah. Margin absolutely. On that?
Not bad.
So it's gross margin of 64%, which is actually higher than the iPhone 8, which has a gross margin of 59%. Now that number was actually, I thought they were going to be cheaper to make than that.
Yeah, I would have thought so too. But I guess it's first gen of a lot of the technology, so they're probably still working that out. But yeah, it's still not a bad gig though. If you're selling, how many hundreds of thousands do they sell at the launch of a new phone?
Oh yeah, millions and millions. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you know, it's there's certainly money that they're making in those, and because there's no third party as well, so most of the time they're not selling them to a retailer in order to sell them to somebody else.
I think that's probably
one other little point I want to touch on when it comes to making profit is if you are going through a distributor and they're distributing a product for you. So let's say it's maybe, you know, fashion or furniture or soft drinks or things like that. You'll find yourself in a position where the distributor actually needs to make a margin as well. So if you sell something for, if you make something for $10 and you sell it to a distributor for $20, the distributor might sell it to the retailer for $40, and the retailer might sell it to the end consumer for $80. So where you've made $10 in your profit from selling it to the distributor, you find your product actually being sold in the end for $80, which is why people like Apple then go, right, well, let's cut out the distributors and the middlemen and let's make all the profit ourselves.
Or have a brand that's so strong that, because I remember it, I think it was Maya. I was buying a laptop a few years ago, and I think they said it was about a 10% margin when they sell Apple products. So it's basically nothing compared to their usual rate, which is probably 50% margin on other products.
Yeah.
So you either offer a much larger margin or have a brand that's so strong that people don't want to be left out and that they're willing to take a lower cut. So yeah,
if you've got a product and I think a lot of the work you need to do with a product and getting it into a retail space is to get your costs down as drastically as you can to make the thing or produce the thing for as cheap as you possibly can. I've seen people with fashion labels where you know, they might be making a dress for $80 and it costs them $80 landed to make that. Now, to sell it direct, you know, it's expensive, especially when you're competing with the Zaras of this world and the H&Ms and that sort of disposable fashion. But if you can if you're landing a dress at $80, you're already going to struggle. If you're landing a dress for $8, then there's a lot more room that you've got to play with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that is the opportunity with products though versus service pricing, is that products are far more scalable. And if you're producing larger quantities, you are usually getting them for a much lower cost per unit, which means you're making higher profits on those. So if you've got a good idea for a product, it's a great way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and that's why people, you know, that's why so many people, you know, buy from China and have things manufactured in China and, you know, and so on. The fourth point I was going to make in terms of working out how to price yourself is to work on the basis of what your competitors sell their products. And I've seen a lot of people that will price themselves either deliberately higher or deliberately lower. And I actually work for a client at the moment that's moving into an overseas market and is going to deliberately price that. They're moving into a market where they've never been before. There are three major competitors that have most of the market stitched up. But these guys are going to go in and deliberately price themselves under, and significantly under, all three of their competitors. Mm. They haven't given any consideration to profit. They're not giving consideration to what the market will pay or what they, because they know they can make the market pay more. And they haven't put any consideration into, you know, what their earnings want to be. But the short-term goal for the first couple of years is to price themselves considerably under the incumbents in the marketplace and grab as much market share as they possibly can.
And how do you think they'll go in raising prices if the time comes?
Well, the question is whether they actually need to.
Yeah.
I think if they do that for a couple of years, I think the question is, can they get significant scale quickly enough that they don't need to raise price? They're a global company. So they've got a supply chain that can help them keep those prices low.
Yeah.
I mean, another good example of somebody who's been doing that for the past, however old they are, he should have researched this, but Amazon. you read the Amazon story, and the pricing in Amazon is deliberately low in order just to destroy the competition.
Because if they can grab that market share, there it's that scalability. Yeah.
Yeah, and then what Amazon does is adds in the Amazon Prime, so it adds in that sort of level that you can upgrade to, knowing that it has hundreds of millions of customers, and if a small proportion of them upgrade to the Amazon Prime, then that's where they can make their profit from. So that's always worth thinking about. Is there any other ones that you can think that have tried to deliberately corner the market based on price?
Oh, putting me on the spot.
It's a brave strategy.
It is. Sorry, go on. And I think it depends, again, on your marketplace. But can I just duck back quickly to the Amazon Prime example? Because that is something that's worth considering in pricing. Because if you have a range of products or services, sometimes it is worth having that sort of lead magnet, you know, whatever you want to call it, that low price product that gets people to know you and gets them to actually buy from you. And once they've bought from you once, the trust is there, they're more likely to buy from you again. So sometimes it is worth having that entry level product that you can then upsell them to, you know, whether it's higher levels of service if you're providing that, or, you know, package products or subscription products or something like that. So that whole idea of a loss leader, which is what the supermarkets often do. And can I bring up the Nutella example? I was just fascinated. So in France, because Nutella is pretty amazing anywhere, but in Europe, it's not like people love Nutella. And there was a supermarket chain in France that discounted Nutella by 70%. Now, that's a product that you really probably don't need to discount. It's got such a strong brand. It's got such a loyal following, but they discounted it. So I can't remember the exact numbers, but if it was normally like €4.50, they had it down to €1.70 or something like that. So it went ballistic, and it was like a riot. People were elbowing each other out of the way, and they were it just caused absolute bedlam. And the reason they would do that is to get people in the door. Because if you go in to buy Nutella, you don't just walk, you know, you buy so many other products, and that's where they'll make their margin then. So sometimes it's worth having a product that you kind of sacrifice your profit, knowing that you can then gain more from that customer and increase their lifetime value. But that's different to discounting your core products. And I think that's where the danger is. Discounting is really hard to recover from. There's certain shops that I quite like their clothes, but I would never buy it on like full price because I know within the next 7 days I'll get an email with the discount voucher, or there'll be a percentage off, or there'll be a, you know, spend this much and get something free. And so you just never pay full price. And that's a dangerous situation to put yourself in.
Well, let's talk about that, the discounting, because I think one of the points you made earlier on is that the beauty of having a higher price is it does give you flexibility to discount. And I'm never a fan of discounting. I think people should avoid discounting at all costs. What I try to say to people is, let's try and deliver added value instead.
Exactly.
Let's try and say to people, if you want to give something back and attract somebody through the door, and rather than give away your cash, let's give them something for that cash. And I think a perfect example, I use this multiple times in the last 10 years, is if you want to go and buy a computer, and I'm going to use Apple again as an example, you try and walk into an Apple store and ask for a discount and see how far that gets you.
Trust me, no, because I've tried.
No, absolutely. You're a brave, brave woman then, doing that. But if you walk into a Harvey Norman store, and again, for those of you that aren't in Australia, Harvey Norman's the... how do we compare Harvey Norman to something in Harvey Norman sells a lot of electric equipment and, you know, that sort of thing. But you walk into Harvey Norman, you can pretty much haggle a deal out of anybody in there.
Yeah.
And I think those are, well, I like to say to clients, you want to be in the Apple space.
Absolutely.
You know, you want to oversell, overhelp, you know, have your genius bar, you know, have too many staff, all wearing the same color t-shirts, that kind of over-servicing. And that's why people will come back. People don't shop at Harvey Norman because they love Harvey Norman.
No.
Unless you love Harvey Norman, and I'm not aware of that.
No, not at all. And the thing is as well with that, so with the Apple example, once people have paid a bit extra, so I mean, Apple products are significantly more expensive than the equivalents from other brands. And before I became an Apple fangirl, I didn't quite understand why you'd be prepared to pay that much more. And now I just don't consider any other brands. And if you could put, you know, another laptop in front of me, and it's just because I'm used to the interface, I love the design, the experience, like when you open one of their boxes and actually try and access whatever it is that you've bought, the whole thing is just beautifully wrapped and it is an experience to actually open the product. But now I have a level of suspicion, because if you look at something else and go, why is it so cheap? And that's the other thing is, if you price yourself too low, people will question why it's so cheap and they'll question the quality. So I think you've got to get that balance right in your pricing, because too cheap usually means crap and falls apart quickly and people are suspicious of that as well.
One of the other points I just want to make, because as we sort of get through this, is one of the lessons that I learned over the years is not to, it's the old adage that I repeat to myself all the time now, which is turnover is vanity, profit is sanity, but cash is reality.
Yeah.
So when people think about how they price themselves, it's all well and good you sending out invoices left, right, and center, and sitting there showing people how much money you've made that month. But it really depends on the margin that you're making. Your business will survive based on that margin. So you could be making, you know, $30,000 a month. But if you've got $25,000 or $28,000 in overheads, your business isn't particularly healthy. It's not healthy at all.
Yeah.
But above and beyond that, if none of that money is in the bank, then you are in an even worse situation. So when you think about the price, you've also got to think about how that converts to actually taking money from a client, or the client paying you. Because if you're overpricing, or you're sitting there saying, well, I'm worth this amount and here's my invoice, if they can't pay you, it's all fairly moot, because yes, you're not going to make any money, because they might take 1 week to pay you, they might take 3 months to pay you.
And I think that's the thing you need to think about in your pricing as well. It's actually, as you said, with the Gardner example, is that padding, so that if one client doesn't pay you, that you've got enough to pay your staff or to pay your overheads. Yeah. If you're that tight on a month-to-month basis that, you know, one bad month or one client cancelling or, you know, one dip in sales on the product because it's January and that's when it's quiet or whatever, then your business is at massive risk. So your pricing isn't necessarily about that, just that one product or service you're offering, but your whole business and your entire business goals and your commitments. And I think that's the other thing for a lot of businesses is getting a really clear understanding of their costs. I'm a bandit for signing up for software. And I'll buy, you know, because you sort of think, oh, it's $30 a month here. That's pretty cheap. Or it's $10 for this. Or this one's only $40 a month. And then suddenly if you do an audit and it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month and some of it I probably haven't used for a few months. So I make myself at the end of sort of every 1 or 2 months go back and sort of say, have I used this? Do I need it? And get rid of it because those things add up. And it is, you know, if you're in a multi-million dollar business, it probably doesn't make a massive deal. But if you're a one person business, then it really does. And so it is a matter of, you know, to keep your pricing solid, you really need to understand your business costs as well.
Do you know how much do you reckon you spend on software every month? What do you reckon it is at the moment?
I reckon it's every month, probably about between $200 and $300 a month.
Yeah. Mine was $500 November last year.
Yeah.
And it dropped down in December a little bit, but I suddenly went, what have I spent $500 in software? I don't have anything to show for it other than I can log into a few websites.
Yeah.
But it was insane. I was doing exactly the same, going, oh, well, I need that for this and I need that for this. And suddenly you find yourself spending $500 a month.
But a bit of cloud storage, a couple of design apps and, you know, a bit of project management software and you're there so quickly and easily. You know, it's really not hard to do. And so, again, if
it's
you're
like,
just going back
it's
to
like
that
crack
early
for
rate,
marketing people.
Oh, yeah, it's dangerous. Yeah,
it's like it's crack for marketing people. Or there's another piece of software that does something cool.
And you just know you get the free version and, you know, and that just play for a little bit and then end up spending a fortune to upgrade to the premium version. They can see me coming a mile off. It's bad when you're a marketer because you should know better, but I still fall for it.
I know. Yeah, exactly. I've got three more final questions that are, or, you know, challenges for us to kind of answer. The first one is, how would you price something in an empty marketplace? So let's say there wasn't any competitors. What would your first steps be if you had a new product in a new marketplace and you didn't know how to approach it?
I guess it goes back to those foundations of knowing your financial goals and knowing your costs. So that's sort of the step one is you have the base level of you at least need to have to cover that. I would want to do some pretty good research into the target audience to understand just how much, I guess, pain or what problem the product or service is solving and how much that means to them in return. So example that comes to mind randomly, but there's people in the marketplace who, you know, they do like the child whisperer, like they come and help get your baby to sleep. If you're a new mother whose child doesn't sleep, you're pretty much willing to pay anything for something like that. So you sort of look back and go,
Take my money.
How much is this of value? And look at that pricing and then, and look at your financial goals and see sort of the axis that all of those things meet and find the pricing from there.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I've had a couple of instances in the past where I've had clients who've created software that didn't have any close comparable competitors. And we went through trying to price it by, you know, costs plus profit margin or aligning it with similar software in similar places. But I think, and that's a really, really interesting point, is that they eventually started to price it on based on the pain that it was saving the client. So it was a piece of software that could help companies reduce their insurance burden. And it was obviously aimed at big, big corporate companies, enterprise size companies, who are spending six figures a year on insurance. And the idea being is that if they implemented this software, they would reduce their insurance bill. They could slash their insurance bill by, let's say, $50,000. I'm making numbers up now, but you get the point. The idea being is that then if you charge $10,000 a year for this software, that made absolute sense because you were going to save them another $40,000.
Absolutely.
And it was at that point, it became a very simple sell. Now, that $10,000 a month, $10,000 a year, that had no bearing on, there was no calculation of profit margins there. There was no comparison to other. It was just purely based on what it was going to save the customer in the long run.
Yeah. And if you can give them within a couple of years, they make that money back, then it's a bit of a no-brainer. So I guess with customers, there's two things you can do. You can either save them time or make them money. And if you're saving them time, you're making them money because it's either their staff that they're not having to, you know, pay as much or have as many, or it's, you know, whatever the cost reduced by saving that time. So if you can sort of say within 2 to 3 years, you know, they've made this much money, like they just, it's exponentially more than what they've paid. It's really not a difficult sell at all. And so then it doesn't come down to anything other than the value providing.
Yeah, I think, and I'll tell you who I think has, over the years has done exactly that, is solar panel companies. I think they price their products based on what electricity you think you're going to save.
Yeah.
But their argument is, are you going to save this electricity over 10 years? So, but it, you know, if you spend this money up front now, you're going to save this amount of money over 10 years. So therefore, it makes absolute sense. I think the challenge is a lot of people don't see that far forward. They're not going, oh, I'm going to still going to be saving money in 5 years' time. It's, you know, maybe that there's a gap there in the marketplace.
And again, it's understanding your target audience, because I will buy things, if it's something I know I will use a lot of, I will buy things in bulk to save a bit of money. So I'd rather spend the money up front, knowing that I'd save the money in the long term. But I've got a friend who will always buy the smallest amount of everything, even though she knows it will cost her more money. It's the short term gain versus the long term gain. And so, you know, there's so many different people in the world, but it's really understanding your target audience. I know I say that a lot, but that's kind of one thing I harp on across all aspects of marketing, is if you don't have that understanding, you know, the Quilton example we were talking about with their handlebar or their handbag toilet paper.
Yes.
But if there are people who'll buy the 30-pack and there'll people who'll buy the 4, and if you don't understand who you're talking to, you're wasting a lot of time and money, and your pricing could be completely irrelevant. And how's that? I brought toilet paper in. For consistency in your podcast, Simon. Ooh, we got through 40 minutes without mentioning toilet paper, but I got it.
Hopefully I'm going to get sponsored by a toilet paper company.
That's right, it's just a matter of time.
Free product. That's I was actually on that note, I keep thinking of and my wife gives me shit about this all the time, but whenever I see Lynx deodorant on 50% off or 2 for 1 in Woolworths or Coles, I always bulk buy. But the problem is, I now bulk buy and there's so many cans of deodorant, I'm probably fine till about 2030 underneath the house.
Does Lynx deodorant go off?
I hope not, because I'm using one from 2014 at the moment, I think. But I just, you know, at least I smell nice. That's the bonus. But what I was going to say is we talk about that pricing, and we talk about brand contributing to that pricing. And we've used Apple as an example, because obviously Apple do a lot of good things in terms of design and product and all those kind of things. And that adds and allows them to be able to price their product as they price it. What are some of the other things that you think brands can do, or just small businesses can do that allow them to be able to charge more from a brand perspective?
I think just the way you present the brand, the language you use, and, you know, again, coming back to that discounting, or always making sure that you appear to value your product or service, gives your customers a much better chance of valuing it as well. And I think it also comes down to customer service. So after that, like that first, however long, but the first sort of immediate experience they have after they've parted with their money will determine the value they've received. So if you buy something and you get it and it's not what you expected, or you know, the experience wasn't really a good one, then you're automatically sort of judging, going, oh, it really wasn't worth it. You're disappointed. Whereas if your experience when you're handing over the money and shortly after is really positive, you feel looked after, you feel like you've got something great, of great quality, then you can justify it to yourself. And I think it's that, you know, the buyer's remorse is pretty strong in customers. So if, you know, when you pay, you feel bad about it, then you're much less likely to come back and do it again. So I think it is, you know, definitely branding and the way that the whole product or service is presented, but customer service is becoming more and more important because it's one of the main differentiators now. Anyone can copy a product or service that you've created, and most people will have their products or services copied or be in a fairly saturated marketplace, but the way you deliver it is what can really set you apart and can justify paying more. So that's why the hairdressers who, you know, charge more probably have a much, you know, a nicer customer experience or provide more, or whether they have the glass of champagne or whatever it might be. And it doesn't have to be things that cost a lot of money. And sometimes it can just be as simple as attention. But there's a author and podcaster in the States called Joey Coleman, and he's sort of a customer service, customer experience expert. And he talks about the first 100 days after, you know, bringing on a client or selling a product, and what can you do in those 100 days to really blow their minds. And if you can do that, then your brand message gets spread, you know, the referrals get spread, and you can easily justify a high price because people have heard all the good things and want to come back to you.
There's a book that I heard, I'm going to buy, and do you know what? I'm now going to try and find it in my list of things I want to buy, and unfortunately, of course, I can't find it, which is always the way. But it's about micro experiences. God, that's really going to annoy me. I've got a long list of books here that I'm supposed to read, and I know it's in here somewhere. There it is. It's called The Power of Moments.
Yeah.
By a guy called Chip Heath. And he tells it, and I think this is the perfect thing about how you can add value to your brand so that you can charge more. And he's got a story in there about a hotel in LA, which I think is the number 2 rated hotel in TripAdvisor. And it is the most nondescript hotel that you'll ever see. It's like a motel, one of those classic American motels.
Yeah.
And he says these guys are number 2 in the whole of LA, with absolutely 5-star reviews, et cetera, et cetera. And he says the way they've done it is through the power of moments. The hotel experience, the stay in the hotel is quite unremarkable. But there's various things that happen around the hotel that make it remarkable. And the example that he uses when you listen to him and in the book is about the red phone that's by the swimming pool. And the red phone has a sign above it saying Popsicle Hotline. And when you pick up that phone, there's someone at the other end that says, "Hello, Popsicle Hotline, what flavor would you like?" And has 3 flavors that you can choose from. And you choose with popsicle that you like. And within a minute, there's a guy, a waiter with a silver tray and white gloves that turns up at the pool and brings you your popsicle. All free of charge, no costs. Yeah, absolutely. And he said the hotel is packed with things like that. I think the other example he uses is a magician. They have a magician in reception who's just there doing sort of sleight of hand card tricks, you know, for a couple of hours every day. But it's those kind of things that you go, when you offer those micro moments, those micro experiences, that then allows you to start charging more, or if not start charging more, discounting less.
Yes.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And possibly capturing more of the market share, or, you know, just increasing your referrals and your word of mouth, as those guys have done, because
absolutely,
you're just creating that experience. And I mean, an example, a local example is the QT hotels, you know, on the Gold Coast. And it's, they're not for everyone, but you walk in, the uniforms are quite different. The whole atmosphere is very unique in terms of hotels on the Gold Coast. But there's, you know, the handmade lemonade there waiting for you. Or if you go to a conference there, some of their food and beverage is really outstanding. Like, it's just, they're so different and such a different approach to it. And because of that, they can justify spending more. And people happily spend more. Because if you get to your room, there may be the cocktail making kit, you know, a tray with different ingredients for you to make your own cocktail and all those sorts of things. And again, it costs a bit of money, but nowhere near the value, the perceived value. And because of that, they can easily charge more.
I just want to repeat that final point for everybody there, is that if you invest in the brand, and if you invest it through different ways, it might be through a, you know, beautiful logo, it might be through those micro moments or micro experiences, through customer service, all those kind of things. The more you invest in the brand like that, the less you have to discount.
Yeah.
Because people come back more often, they recommend you more often, they talk about you to their friends more often, and they spend more money with you. So if you don't want to find yourself in this ever sort of decreasing circle of discounting, this vicious circle of discounting, then overinvest in your brand. And that might take time, and it might be difficult to start with. But if you do that, it will set you up for the long term. Now, the final question I've got for you, which is your final challenge question today. How do you, if you're in a business, how do you raise your prices? How do you put them up? What language do you use? What do you say to your customers? What's the process that you would go through?
It really depends on the business and the audience. I think people have an understanding. So there's some industries where they just understand that costs increase, you know, every year or whatever it might be, and so that prices increase, and there's that level of understanding. But it depends how it's positioned. Like health insurance, you know, the 1st of April, there is always a price increase. There's not necessarily a real explanation as to why it's the 1st of April or why there has to be a price increase. And so a lot of customers get dirty about that. And also, so the marketing's now in a cycle that there's health funds advertising that they're the lowest increase price, like there's a lowest price increase for the year. One came up just today for me in an ad somewhere on social media, and that was their tagline or their call to action on their ad, was that they had the lowest price increase this year. Not that they didn't have one, but it was the lowest, so didn't really make me inspired to buy from them. But I think that's, you know, there's the fine line of having customers understand that prices increase, therefore your costs increase, therefore prices increase, without it appearing to be a poor me situation or a, you know, like you're not in control of your business. I think it's a really, really tricky one, which is firstly why I would always say, you know, look ahead and price accordingly, because putting prices up is really hard. You know, a lot of businesses these days won't put the price up, but they will reduce the overhead. So, you know, in a supermarket's example, every chip packet, every lolly packet, they've small, you know, much smaller than they used to be. So they might be the same price as they were 3 years ago, but you're not getting as much product. Yeah. Again, yeah, you question those tactics in that, you know, the ill will or the feeling of customers being duped, like, you know, do they really think we're that dumb? There's a lot of that, but then people do settle in. So if the brand's well established enough, they seem to get away with it. It's such a case-by-case basis, because I think it's a really tricky one. But if you have provided a good enough service, if you do have a great brand, it comes down to that thing you said earlier on, is you didn't even look at the price of your gaming experience. So if you're keeping your customers really happy, they probably won't even notice or care, because if the value you're providing is more than the price increase, then, you know, it's not, they're not going to be quibbling over those $1 and $2 differences. Pricing is so reliant on everything else you're doing in your product and your marketing.
There's a specific name that you mentioned for that, you know, when companies, instead of putting their prices up, just reduce the size of the packaging. And I wish I could remember it, because every time I have this conversation, I can never remember it. It's a specific, it's like something like reverse inflation or something bizarre like that.
I think that is it, isn't it?
Is it? Yeah. Is that, maybe
I think
it
so.
Is. If anyone knows out there, then please email me and tell me. The two things that came out of what you just said there, I was going to say, is number one, if you look at how Apple put their prices up, and I think this is quite a cunning way, and I know not every business can do this, but they simply replace their product line every 18 months.
Yes, yeah.
With a new product line. And that product line might be a slightly increased price, or, you know, they might have, you know, slashed some margin in terms of the manufacture. But every 18 months, they're replacing the entire, or in the case of the phone, sometimes 12 months. But they're replacing the entire product line with a new product that at a new price. So there's never any kind of discussion about, oh, Apple are putting prices up.
Yeah,
I mean, they talk
right.
about the iPhone X being more expensive, but that's a new product. So it has no comparable product where people can say, well, it's more expensive than the previous model. Well, of course it is, because it's a completely different product. So I think if people can think of ways that, instead of putting their prices up, they can simply replace what they do, their products, their services, or rebuild their services, or reoffer their services, yeah. or
just repackage them
at a different
price.
A
little bit more value. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the other one I wanted to touch on, because I think this is a perfect example of where people have put prices up for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Well, and I think to the detriment long term of the business and the health of the business, was a company that you and I both work for, which was Forex.
Mm-hmm.
And how they used to go through every year that whole consumer price index increase. And I don't know if you remember, but you know, the letters used to go out to the customer.
Yeah, absolutely.
You had to go in there and explain to them why everything had gone up by 3% and blah, 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 blah. But of course, every year the product was still on special once every fortnight, and it was still on special at the same price.
And it goes back to that argument of why would you buy it at the, you know, recommended retail price, whether it's beer, whether it's clothing, whether it's anything, if you know perfectly well that if you just wait a little bit longer, you'll get it cheaper.
I came to Australia in 2003 and I worked for Heineken for about the first 6 months that I was here, and we were selling Heineken in, and we were pleased when we saw Heineken on special in bottle shops as a carton of beer for $44. So that's 24 bottles, again, for people who don't know the Australian marketplace. 24 bottles, 330 mils, $44. That to us was considered the bottom of the price that we wanted to see it on special. If you walk into a First Choice or a Dan Murphy's here today, and bear in mind that was 2003 and this is now 2018, so it's 15 years later, you can still get a carton of Heineken on special for $44. Most weeks, you know, maybe one out of 3 weeks. And if it isn't Heineken, it's Beck's. And if it isn't Beck's, it's Carlsberg. And if it's not Carlsberg, it's Stella. It's something similar kind of brand. But then you go, but there's been 15 years of price increases
and cost
between
increases
the brewery.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, you know, cost of manufacture, you know, labor, all those kind of things. That's all increased, but it's still... So, you know, obviously the margins have been squeezed, you know, quite drastically for the manufacturer, because it's certainly not Coles and Woolworths who are losing money over these things. But I always thought, you know, back in our time at Forex, that was one of the, it was like a ritual.
You could set your watch by it, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
I guess that's, you go.
No, go on, you go.
I just think that was, you know, one thing from our time then, and one consideration when we're talking about pricing, and it's industry specific, but then not really, is just the legal aspects of price fixing, of discussing prices with competitors. You know, so if you're looking at your competitors in the market, you certainly can't be discussing prices. There are pretty severe legal consequences. So not everyone necessarily knows the extent of that. And depending on your industry or what, you know, what area you're in, it's worth looking into all of that legislation. I think a lot of people might not be aware. I'm definitely not an expert in it, but it is another consideration when you're looking at pricing, is that you've got to make sure you're discussing it internally and not externally.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, that's been fantastic. I hope that is a help to people out there if they are. And I don't just hope this is a help to people who have got a new product or they're starting a business and want a price, but I think it's, want to understand their pricing, but I think it should be useful for people that I've been perhaps in business for a long time and need to sit there and go, you know what, I don't make as much profit as I should do, or I've not got as much money in the bank as I should do. Perhaps it is time to sort of sit down and re-examine what you sell and the price you sell it at.
Because the ideal situation is you put your prices up and you work less and you make more.
Absolutely.
That can and does happen. So,
if you're in a business out there and you are continually finding yourself being undercut by competitors, then there's something wrong with your pricing. What you need to do is you need to get yourself into a position where you can be undercut by your competitors, but it doesn't affect your business. That is a beautiful position to be in. You know, that's what a lot of the major brands find themselves in, that they can charge whatever they like because they have those fans who are willing to pay for anything, like myself and Kim with Apple. But, you know, take a look at your pricing. Take a look at this week at what price you're selling out at, whether your services, whether your products, all those kind of things. Just re-examine them. And it might be in a couple of years. You see, you know, over that time, you know, people might, costs have increased. People might not have calculated their gross margin for like 2 or 3 years. They might be sitting there going, oh, actually, wow, you know, I'm making $10 less on that product than I was 3 years ago. So have a think about it and review it. Any sort of final words from yourself, Kim, about that?
I think it just really goes back to, as we mentioned, really comes down to the strength of your brand. So you have the freedom to, you know, increase prices or look at those gross margins or make those decisions when your brand is strong enough that the customers see the value in what you're doing. If your brand is built on price, then you're a lot more tied or restricted to where you can go.
And very finally, I just want to say there isn't anything wrong with a brand that is built on price. There is plenty of them out there. Plenty of them make a lot of money as well. But if that's not you, then do what Kim suggests and invest in your brand and take a look at your brand and work out how you can maintain a higher price without having to get stuck in that discounting. Kim, thank you very much for coming in. It's been much more informative than having Simon Bell here because, quite frankly, compared to you, he is useless. And I'm hoping he'll hear that. He'll hear that and he'll never talk to me again. I'm sure he will. So just very quickly, if anyone wants to get in contact with you, where can they find you?
They can find me. My website is kimogorman.com.au, and that's Kim with a Y. Or on Twitter and Instagram, I'm Cog Marketing, K-O-G Marketing.
I really love that name. It's like, you know, it really works.
Thank you.
do you know, I'll be honest, when I first saw it, Cog Marketing, I thought, why has she called herself Cog Marketing? It took me about 30 seconds to work that one out, Kim.
I hate it when words are spelt incorrectly. So if you don't make the connection of my initials and think I've just spelt Cog, you know, the wrong way to be different, that drives me nuts. So it is my initials. For those of you who don't take the time, it is my initials.
My pet hate is brands with numbers in where there should be letters.
Oh, yes.
Like straight with an 8 in it.
That's a whole episode. The things that drive us nuts about.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. We'll be here for another hour. Thank you very much, Kim. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you want to get a hold of me, excuse me, you said coughing. I'm on Twitter. I am Simon Dell. LinkedIn, I am Simon Dell. My website is simondell.com. And if you want to email me, look, if you've got any comments out there about how you've priced things, some ideas around how people should price their businesses or things that they should look at, please, please, please email me and let me know. My email is simon@simondell.com and I will answer every single email. I'm committing to that. So once again, Kim, thanks very much and we'll see you all next week.
See you later.